Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Math can be a pretty boring subject, I know from experience, even though, yeah, I did all the math courses growing up. But that's a real problem when it comes to working on your money. If you think it's boring, if you don't want to do it, it's a problem. So we have a new math educator in town, and there is nothing boring about Kyne Santos. She is the Canada Drag Race alum who is teaching math to her 1.4 million TikTok followers. She's going to be here in full, beautiful makeup and hair to talk about her focus. Then renewing your mortgage is one thing, but what about actually qualifying in the first place and qualifying when you are self-employed? Colin Graves is managing editor of Retire Happy, and he's gonna be here to take us through what you need to know about mortgages when you work for yourself. Dealing with debt can make people feel really, really anxious, but if you're someone who leaves a balance on your credit card during this time, you may encounter a scenario where you can't pay it off, like you just can't pay it off. So what happens if you don't pay off your credit card? And we're going to talk about short term, like what happens if it's 1 month, what happens if it's 3 or 4, all the various situations. Doris Essiadu is a credit counselor at Credit Canada, and she'll be here to join us to talk about that. Plus, how can you have a happy relationship with your money? And that isn't just for people who've got lots of it. Ken Honda is the author of Happy Money, the Japanese art of making peace with your money. He'll be here from Tokyo to take us through his book and tell us how you can choose to be happy. Choose to be happy. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. One of the hurdles that people have when it comes to getting a handle on their money is the math. Some people get so weird about math. They feel overwhelmed by it. They feel stupid when it comes to numbers. So I believe that if we can do a better job engaging people on the basic math, we can help people with their money. And I think I may have a kindred spirit on that, joining us as our next guest, because there are so many approaches to trying to do that. And today we're going to talk about one that focuses on a little bit of eyeliner and glitter to make math less of a drag. We're going to talk about it in drag. Canada's Drag Race alum Kyne took to TikTok to teach her followers about math. And there's upwards of like what 1.5 million of these followers on TikTok. She joins us from Kitchener, Ontario to tell us more. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. I mean, my questions must begin with the number one most important question I could ask. Mm-hmm. It is probably the most important number that our listeners need to know. How many wigs do you own?
Oh gosh. Oh, yeah. Too many to count.
Really?
Probably like 30 to 40, 30. Somewhere around there.
Okay. Do you have a favorite? I mean, the one you've got on today is extraordinary, but do you have a favorite?
Ooh, okay. Actually, I have this wig. I haven't found the right occasion to wear it yet. I'm a bit of a shopaholic, I'd say. Okay. But it's like this huge yellow foam wig. I haven't worn it yet, though, but it's fabulous. Fantastic.
How long does it take to get a wig into show-ready shape?
Well, it takes a couple of hours. Thankfully, I learned how to style my own wig, so I can sort of do it myself. Other queens, they will like hire people to do it. I could style a wig in like 2-3 hours.
Oh my God, amazing. Okay, so I want to know what your connection to math was growing up. Was this always easy for you? Did you love math growing up, or were you a late convert?
I did love math when I was growing up. It was always my best subject in school. I didn't always think it was like amazing and beautiful and fantastic. I remember it coming pretty naturally to me when I was a kid. You know, my dad was an engineer, and he always said that math was his favorite subject. So I guess that sort of that had a little influence on me. But in high school, I remember my teachers would encourage me to do math contests, which were like extracurricular math tests. Yeah. I know what you're thinking. Ooh, fun. But I am really thinking that. No, I loved it. I was a total mathlete. And those math contests were sort of my introduction to sort of this fun, creative side of math. Because usually in school, we learn math as in like solve for X, do this formula, get the right answer. And yeah, I was like, I was pretty good at that, but I didn't really know what it was for or what mathematicians like did for a living. But when I got introduced to like creative math and proofs based math, where there's not necessarily one right way to get to the answer, that's where I started thinking, oh, math is actually quite artistic and elegant. And that's sort of my message to everyone, because I did end up studying math in university, and it's my favorite subject.
Yeah. Well, drag's artistic, drag is creative. So sure. let's go there. What was your entry into the world of drag?
It's funny, because when I was young, I grew up not around drag queens or not around any queer people. I thought drag queens were all like men with like some weird fetish to dress as women.
Right.
But it was RuPaul's Drag Race that sort of humanized it for me. And right. I sort of got turned on to the show after seeing enough memes on Instagram. And I was like, let me tune into this. At the time, I was sort of like experimenting with makeup. So I guess makeup was sort of my entryway into drag. I loved watching like beauty gurus on YouTube, and I just wanted to be like them. So right. I was like cross-dressing, going to school, but not calling it drag yet right. until I saw drag queens on TV and on stage eventually, sort of combining that love for makeup and the artistry with performance and dance and music. It was all of my favorite things lumped into one. And once I saw that drag was really a creative outlet, that's what really attracted me to it.
Okay, so now bring these two things together. I see the mathlete, I see the drag performer, and then there was this alchemy, this insight, this explosion where you said, that's going to be a part of what I do and I'm going to TikTok.
It's funny, people always ask me that, but it totally just happened as a coincidence. I never intended to sort of blend those two worlds together. I really was like Hannah Montana in school. I was like studying math during the day, like studying for my test. And then at night I was like going on stage. I never thought that people on one side had any interest in the other. It was sort of the boredom of the pandemic that sort of got me on TikTok. I, like many other people, I thought TikTok was like just for kids, like to do little dances on. And then once I started seeing people do like these skits and these like really funny creative videos, I was like, oh, well, what could I do that's different? Because like people sort of knew me in public as a drag queen. But I was like, oh, wouldn't it be funny if I started just telling math riddles and got right. in a video and said, oh, if a car is traveling at 90 kilometers per hour, how long would it take? Because that's kind of just how my brain works. And, right. you know, to me, it's entertaining. But I was like, oh, if a drag queen did that, it would kind of be like the troll the under the bridge. Like, it would telling be the
it's like the Trojan horse.
It was
horse.
Just funny to me, right? Yeah. So I put it out there, not really expecting anything from it. And then, like, right away, people started commenting, oh, my gosh, like, finally, I'm starting to understand math. I would love it if my teacher was a drag queen. You make it seem so fun. So there you have now, it. From then, I became the math queen.
You became math queen. Now, I've seen a bunch of your stuff on TikTok. Give us a couple of examples of topics that you cover, just to whet people's appetite.
Sure. Well, one of the first videos that went really viral, I talked about how if you take a piece of paper from the computer and you fold it in half 42 times, the thickness of that paper would extend from the earth to the moon.
Really?
Yeah, that was like, it blew people's minds.
I'm sure. And I love, because sometimes you have like a piece of paper with a marker there and you're doing little demonstrations.
Yeah, sometimes people will ask, hey Kine, why does 0 factorial equal 1, or why is a number to the power of 0 equal to 1? So I'll sort of bring the paper and pencil out and explain it.
The thing that you've said that I can't imagine, I can't recall ever hearing before, is the artistry of math and the intersection of those two things, which I think is genius, because a lot of people, my 13-year-old included sometimes, have a hard time making the connection to the theoretical math and what they might use it for in real life. How do you answer that question?
It's tough because, you know, the way that math is taught in schools, it's always like teachers sort of teaching math to the test, and you're sort of just taught to memorize these procedures so that you can apply them on the test and then forget them right afterwards. But what I love about math is when you can sort of make those theorems make sense in your mind and you're able to derive them from scratch. And what I like is that all equations, you don't really need to memorize them. You can always start from scratch and get to the quadratic formula. So it's about math really just being a system of patterns and logic and deduction. It's not really about memorizing and using symbols and stuff. All of that is more superficial, but really at its core, math is just about logic and seeing patterns. And that's how we can use math everywhere.
Mm. One of the things, and pardon me if I don't articulate this as clearly as I could, but many drag performers have different personas, mm-hmm. and the makeup and the dress and the hair bring out the different, the essence of different characters.
Oh, yes, honey.
Okay, good. Okay, I'm like I think that's so. So when you think of that, what are some examples of personas that are an expression for you, and what's their math equivalent? So do you have a freewheeling character persona that teaches one type of thing, and like a hardcore disciplinarian, you know, driven sort of person that might teach another? How does that level come into play?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I guess in a sense, you're right. I do have many sides to me, but I sort of, my message is sort of just that you don't have to be one thing. You can be really girly and want to play with makeup and dresses and wear bright sequins and rainbow colors. And you can also be really into numbers and patterns. You don't have to sort of just choose one box that society sort of puts you in. You have the freedom to do whatever you want in life. And that's sort of the message that I put out, that you can do anything. And I don't even just do math videos. You know, people will know me for doing wig tutorials. I talk a lot about just history and culture nowadays. Anything that I think is interesting and that would enrich my life, I think, oh, some other people would probably be interested in this.
Growing up a gay man, I would go to drag shows. There's something in the LGBTQ culture that is so compelling about that as performance art, but it also really resonates with young people. And we saw that with the drag queen story time. Kids love to go hear drag queens regardless of their sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. What do you think that is? What's the essence of that for kids?
I think drag queens are like superheroes. They're like huge, they're larger than life. They sort of represent this idea that when you're an adult, you don't have to just wear brown all the time. You can still have fun. You can still express yourself and do the things that you like to do when you were a kid, like put a towel on your head and pretend like you had long hair.
Yeah.
Play dress up. One day I'm a princess. One day I'm a cowboy. And I think it's that playfulness that attracts people of all ages.
What is next for you? You're looking into your crystal ball with an extraordinary hairpiece and nails that took ages to affix. What's next for you? What's next for the Math Queen?
Oh gosh. Well, I just love doing what I do. I love educating people. I like doing the short form videos. I'm really just happy doing what I'm doing now, really, being my own boss. But in the future, I am putting out a book next year, which I'm very excited for people to read. It's going to be about me and my life and math and drag and all those intersections that we talked about today.
Amazing. Well, thank you for taking the time to come and talk to us. And thank you for providing such a unique and compelling voice for everybody to learn more about math.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up next on Moolala, what happens if you don't pay off your credit card? Dora Sissiedu from Credit Canada is going to talk about some of the implications, some of the things to know, and what you can do about it if you find yourself in that circumstance. And later, we'll speak with Colin Graves. He is managing editor at Retire Happy, and he's going to talk about qualifying for a mortgage when you're self-employed. To stay up to date on all things Moolala, we have a very simple, very clear monthly newsletter. So if you go to moolala.ca, you can sign up for that and you'll find links to all the things that we've been up to over the course of the prior month. CBC, CityLine, BNN Bloomberg, blah, blah, blah.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple, is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest-standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. Having a level of credit card debt is stressful for anyone. But what happens if there comes a time when you just can't pay off your credit card? Sometimes you can't even make the minimum payment. There are implications if you find yourself in those circumstances. And we want to get ahead of that, provide some context on what happens, whether it's you or someone you know, someone you love. Doris Essiedu is a counselor at Credit Canada. She joins us now from Shelburne, Ontario. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
It is our pleasure. I want to start off with the feeling side of it, in that many times people aren't able to pay their credit cards. It happens to people. And we are going to get into the specifics on it. But what is the first thing that you would say when someone picks up the phone and says, listen, this is what I am dealing with? Where do you start?
Yeah, that's a good question. So first of all, I'll let the client know they're not alone. We hear this many times from our clients, but we're here to support them. I also want to find out why they're in that position, get an assessment, and see how we can support them.
We're going to talk about the various circumstances that one could be in, beginning with the very beginning. So it happens once. You can't pay your credit card bill, let's say the minimum payment. It happens once. What happens in that very first month?
In the first month, you're most likely to get a call from the creditor because you miss your payment. Also, the credit report, they're going to report at the credit bureau that you miss your payment. Mm-hmm. So that's not a good thing.
No. And if that, if they do make that report, and they will, it's automated, how significant a hit would that be to your credit score? Like, is there, you know, three chances, or is it a significant hit really just after missing that one?
Yeah. So the first missed payment, it's not going to be that significant. However, it will still be reported as an R2, which means you've missed your payment within the month. In terms of points, it's hard to say how many points it will go down by. But being that it's the first, it's not going to be that significant.
Now, some people are in dire financial straits, and that is why they have missed. Some people, they just forgot. Something happened. They didn't get the, you know, someone hid that statement under a piece of paper and it's just, they didn't see it. They forgot to pay it. Can you call your lender and just beg forgiveness?
I wish that was the case, but unfortunately, I don't think so. Once you miss a payment, it will be reported. Now, you want to be proactive and take steps to avoid that. So for example, if you know you're going to miss a payment, you can reach out to the creditor in advance and explain the situation. They might have an internal hardship that they can offer, or you can also set up like automated payments so you don't forget that, or put it on your calendar, on your phone, anywhere that will give you that reminder so that you're going to be on top of your game and not miss a payment to begin with.
So that was the 1 month. There is you said an R2 on your credit report. What happens at 2, 3, 4, 5? If that problem persists, then what happens?
Yeah, so when it gets to third and fourth month, then it's getting critical. So we're getting into the calls really coming, and that's when you really need to seek help because it's not going to be very easy. And a lot of times, the reality is if people miss the first payment, what are the chances that they can make like a double payment in the second or third month? So you really need to seek help and get it sorted out.
It is not an all or nothing thing, I think, is a worthy reminder for folks. You are much, much better off if you just make the minimum payment. Is that correct?
Yes, because making minimum payments at least will help you to maintain your good credit. If ideally you want to pay off the credit card balances in full each month, but if you can't, you're better off just making a minimum payment so your credit doesn't take a hit.
At what point does your account go to a collections agency? There's a fair amount of like mythology about who those people are and, you know, what those calls feel like, but it isn't the first step. You said you'd get a call from a creditor first. At what point do they pass you on to something that might be somewhat less polite?
Yeah. So legally, if you miss a payment, a creditor can send you to collections right away. But in general, what we see usually around the third month is when they will start within like the creditor's internal collections to see if they can work out an agreement or something. If that doesn't work, then it goes to a third party collection agency. So I would say between the third and the fourth month is what we see.
And when you say an agreement, what would be some examples of what that could look like? What might the lender offer?
So the lender, based on my experience as a credit counselor, clients have told me sometimes they can offer them no interest for a period of time, maybe for 6 months to see how things go. Some lenders have internal hardship programs that they can offer clients. So they might work out a reduced payment plan just to see how things go. So it all depends on the lender and also the client circumstances.
What advice do you have for people to up the probability that they could find a solution with the lender before things get even worse? Is it being proactive? Is it charm? Is it articulating your hardship in the most compelling way? How would you prepare someone for that phone call that I'm sure would be very stressful for someone to make?
That can be stressful, especially when we're talking about money. And I think for the most part, for what I hear from clients, they are a little bit afraid to approach the creditor because they don't know how they will receive their message. So it's a little bit of both, being proactive, being confident, and explaining your situation before it gets out of control is what the creditor is looking for. And just so consumers know, the creditors, they're also there to help. If the consumer is able to get to them earlier, sooner than later, it can solve a lot of these credit problems.
There is a scenario or a risk in which a credit card company could take you, the client, to court. How often does that happen?
That depends again on a number of factors. Number one would be assets. So if the consumer has an asset, there is a higher probability that a creditor might take legal action. So let's say they have a home with equity in it, so they can put a lien on their house. If the client is working, they can get a court order to get their wages to be garnished. So I would say usually about a year or so, if debts are not taken care of, then you are reaching the point where legal action could happen. Mm.
There are people in this circumstance who do have income coming in. They, you know, some people have nothing coming in, but some people do have income coming in. It's just not enough to cover everything. How would you advise them to prioritize those expenses? What comes first? What comes second? What comes third?
I think the basic necessities should always come first. So i.e. housing, utilities, those are the primary need that we all have to be able to meet and therefore should be taken care of first. Not that the debts are not important, but you need a roof over your head to be able to sleep and even get to work in the morning to make money to pay the debts.
So. What about student debt? And this may be a misconception on my part. It seems that, especially student debt that has some sort of tie to government, there are more protections, more flexibility on repayment plans, and student debt could be lower down the list. Am I correct or not on that?
I think every debt is important. It's all about how the individual is handling the situation. Of course, student loans, if they're not paid, sometimes the government can take different actions too. Maybe your tax refunds, you might not get it. So really just, again, communication is the key, reaching out to the student loan department. I know there are programs like Repayment Assistance Program where they can stop interest for about 6 months. And then if the client's situation hasn't changed, they can reapply and get that again. So it's really about letting the creditor know what your situation is so a mutual agreement can be made.
You receive hundreds and hundreds of calls. You personally handle hundreds and hundreds of calls with people over the course of a year. So, there are options. And it's one of the great things about credit counselors. They've got options. Take us through the options that you would put on the table. And obviously the fit would depend on circumstance. But what are some of the options that might be available to people who just simply can't get a hold of that credit card debt?
Yeah. So again, really understanding the client situation, going through an assessment to determine what is the best solution for them. The assessment will include collecting income, assets, debts, and then seeing what would be the best fit. Sometimes options might be a client reaching out to their creditors directly to negotiate, you know, a lower rate of interest. Other times, given depending on the client's credit, they might qualify for maybe a loan through their bank or a line of credit, something with a lower interest rate so they can pay off the debts in a much faster way. Other options might be consumer proposal, which is legal option, or a bankruptcy, but we want to use those as a last resort due to the obvious impact it will have on the credit. Or credit counseling, we also have a program that we can administer to the consumer if that's the right way to go.
Well, let's round out our conversation with that. What are the basics on this debt consolidation program that the nonprofit credit counselors, not just Credit Canada, but any nonprofit credit counselor, how does that work? What does that provide for the client? And how does it include the creditors?
Yeah. Okay. So a DCP or a debt consolidation program is an informal agreement, which is between three parties. So the client, the creditor, and the credit counseling agency who is administering that. The DCP will basically consolidate unsecured debts into a one monthly affordable payment. So by unsecured, I'm referring to credit cards, personal loans, lines of credit, basically anything without a collateral. When you talk about mortgages or car loans, those would not be included because these are secured loans. So when we combine these debts under one umbrella, the agency's role is to disperse that monthly to the creditor on behalf of the client until the debt is completely paid off. It can range from 3 to 4 years, maximum 5 years, or in cases where the consumer has the ability to pay it faster, it's open, so they can pay it faster and be out of that debt. The main benefits of doing a DCP, first of all, you're getting a one monthly payment, so it's manageable, it's affordable. Collection calls will cease, so those calls that keeps clients up at night and, you know, make them lose sleep at night, all of that will stop. And then I think one of the most important benefits is interest. Interest rates could either be reduced or in some cases eliminated, depending on who the creditors are. And again, it's a big deal for clients because based on my experience working here at Credit Canada, I hear this a lot. You know, clients would say, I've been paying this religiously for the past like 20 years, but I'm still stuck. I can't get out. And it's because of the interest. So what I say to that is like they're spinning their wheels. You know, they're not really moving anywhere. But once that program is set up for them, provided they make the payment consistently based on the agreement, there is no doubt that they will definitely be out of debt. So.
A solution. There are solutions. Doris, thank you for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Doris Assiadou is a counselor at Credit Canada, and she was here to talk about what happens if you don't pay off your credit card debt.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, how to qualify for a mortgage when you're self-employed. It's a little bit more complicated. Colin Graves from Retire Happy will be here. But first, we'll speak to Ken Honda. He has written a book called Happy Money: The Japanese Art of Making Peace with Your Money. And he must be a pretty peaceful dude because it's 4 a.m. in Tokyo and he was bright as a bean. I would not be. I am never up super early in the morning. In fact, afternoons on Wednesday, I'm hanging out on CBC Radio. So I tell you that because maybe we could connect there too. So right now we're on Sirius XM, but on CBC Radio, I pull a topic from the news, something that affects you and affects your financial life. And we have a little yak about it. So join us on CBC.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
No matter what your financial situation is, how can you create a life of abundance by changing your relationship with money? This is the question that's explored in Ken Honda's book, Happy Money: The Japanese Art of Making Peace with Your Money. He joins us now from Tokyo, Japan, to talk more about the book and how you can choose happy money. Hello there, and thank you for getting up at 4 a.m. to talk to us. We appreciate
it. Hello, Bruce. Hey, hi, this is Ken Honda. I just woke up early, and I'm so excited. This is a beautiful way of starting my day in Tokyo.
Fantastic. Now, you begin the book with this amazing story about someone looking through your wallet, and they were looking to see if your money was smiling. What does that even mean? How could she tell? And what was the answer?
I was at the party in Tokyo, and she approached me. At the time, you know, magazine article, they were focusing on what kinds of wallets celebrities do have, you know. Wouldn't that be interesting to see what Justin Bieber and all those celebrities, you know, do they even have a wallet? So, okay. And I told her, as long as you give it back to me, you can take a look at my wallet. And she pulled out all the bills and she was checking something. And she was saying, this is okay. This is great. This is wonderful. And she put back all the bills and gave it back to me. And I asked her, what are you doing? And she said, I was checking if I could see you're okay. And Ken, you're good to go. And I asked her, what am I good to go? It sounds good, but what is it? She said, you must have made a lot of people smile and happy. That's why all the bills in your wallet are smiling. And I still didn't get it. And she said, I'm psychic and I see things that other people don't see. And she says, if you're making people happy and receive money, your money is smiling in your wallet. And if you're taking advantage of other people or do the work that you don't like and get money, your money is crying or getting upset in your wallet. And I thought it's interesting. And I started to wonder what kinds of money is in my friend's wallet. And I had so much fun thinking about it. That's the story goes.
Wow. I can imagine some of our listeners are like, that is a little too woo-woo for
yes,
me.
Yes.
But it's it's an amazing part of your journey, and your book is fascinating. You use a phrase called happy money. How mm-hmm. do you define that phrase, and what are some examples of it?
Happy money makes you smile when you receive it. When you make money, you just receive money from your clients and companies. And if you can smile with the money, that's happy money. And also on the other end, when you spend money, and if you just feel joy and makes you happy, that's also happy money. So when you write checks and pay bills and still keep smiling, that's happy money.
Now, I can imagine that the biggest yeah, but our listeners mm-hmm. will have is yeah, but I don't have any money, so I can't be happy about it. To what do you say to them?
Right. So happy money doesn't really matter if you have so much or so little, because it's your relationship with money. I've met and I have interviewed many millionaires and billionaires in my career as an author. I have found many unhappy ones. And at the same time, among those who are struggling financially, I found some who are doing well emotionally because they receive money with happiness and also spend money with happiness.
Fascinating stuff. Ken, thank you so much for joining us and for providing your insight. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Bruce. You've asked the best questions ever, and
excellent.
I really enjoyed being interviewed.
Excellent. Excellent. And I wasn't trying to be likable, but I hope that I am. I hope that I am.
Yes, I bet you're so popular in North America. So I'm so honored. I feel so honored, and thank you. This is a great way of starting my day.
Thank you so much. Ken Honda's book is called Happy Money, The Japanese Art of Making Peace with Your Money. He joined us very, very early from Tokyo, Japan. Coming up, qualifying for a mortgage when you're self-employed. How do you go about doing it? Colin Graves is with Retire Happy, and he's going to take us through the process and share some tips. If you have missed an episode of Moolala, very simple to go listen to episodes or interviews from the past. Two options. One is to go to the website, moolala.ca. On the top right is a pull down for the podcasts, and then you'll find a little search button. So you can scroll through and look at segments or episodes, full episodes, but you can also type in the name of a topic like retirement or kids and money or estate planning or debt or whatever, and you'll get a whole bunch of options there. You can also search by the name of the guest. So take a look. We're now at 203 episodes, something like that. It's nuts. But we've still got much more on this episode.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Mortgages are a super big topic these days, in large part because interest rates have been moving. Everybody's trying to predict where they're going to move next. And for people renewing, it's one thing, but for people who are trying to qualify in the first place, it can be a really, really stressful process. Imagine if, to add to that, you're someone who is self-employed. That is a layer of complexity that's just a whole lot different than if you've got a traditional job. To talk about the process and how you can up the likelihood that you will qualify for a mortgage when you're self-employed, we're joined by Colin Graves. He is the managing editor of a platform called Retire Happy, and he joins us from Winnipeg, Manitoba. Hello there, Colin.
Hey, Bruce. It is good to be here.
Thank you for joining us. What are some of the differences for people who are self-employed? What are some of the things that lenders look at? And these two things are not the same.
Yeah, I think there's two big things with self-employment that differ from, say, a salaried or hourly job. And that is that, first of all, for most self-employed individuals, your income is fluctuating. Mm-hmm. And so it can base whether you have a busy seasons and different times of year you're busier, or say you're a freelancer and you know your work kind of goes up and down. Your income is fluctuating. The other issue is that most self-employed people have the opportunity to write off a lot of their expenses, that kind of thing. And so their net income, the income they pay tax on, can be significantly less sometimes than the gross revenue that they bring in.
So those two differences acknowledged. As a self-employed person starts their research, are they looking for a particular product, like a different product, or are they looking for lenders who are able to think more holistically when they come to assessing their application?
Yeah, so it's not really, for the most part, it's not really a different product. A mortgage, a personal mortgage is a mortgage is a mortgage. There are some financial institutions that kind of advertise, hey, we have self-employed mortgages. But in my experience, that's more of a marketing thing. They may be saying that, you know, we will have some flexibility in how we adjudicate the mortgage, knowing that you're self-employed, but it's really the same product. What people need to understand is that there's A lenders and there's B lenders, and A lenders are your banks and your big five banks, major banks, and your credit unions. And A lenders are the most conservative lenders when it comes to mortgage lending, which means that they have the highest requirements when it comes to your income confirmation, that kind of thing. And so sometimes if you're self-employed, you may struggle to get approved for a mortgage through an A lender because of the strict requirements they have and the way they assess your income. And so in that case, sometimes often self-employed people have to go through what's called a B lender who offer some more flexibility.
And there's nothing wrong with a B lender. I've been with a B lender for most of my mortgage career. It's a different, it's, you know, less branding, often a much more competitive rate. It's not like a B lender is equivalent to getting a mortgage through an organized crime syndicate.
No, that's right. B lenders, sometimes the rates, because you're getting it as a self-employed individual, and if you can't provide the standard income confirmation, then the B lender may charge a bit of a higher rate, like maybe it's a point or two higher than what you're going to get at a bank or credit union. But they're still reputable lenders and have very flexible products.
So there is the income piece. Yep. What are some of the other pieces that come into play on approval?
Well, like with any mortgage, you obviously have to, the financial institution, the lender needs to make sure that you can afford the payments, which is where the income piece comes in. But you also have to have the adequate down payment that's required. And so that's another big piece right there. And then your credit score, obviously, you know, the stronger your credit, the better your chances of getting a mortgage, especially with an A lender. They are going to want to deal with borrowers who have stronger credit scores.
What are they looking for from an income confirmation standpoint? So if you've got a job, it's a T4. There you go. You got a T4 connected to your tax return, perhaps, or you get a letter from your employer that writes out your salary, whatever. For a self-employed person, what are they looking for?
Yeah, so first of all, just say for the salaried, for a regular salaried employee, you could use a T4, but the institution's going to want to have a couple recent pay stubs, or like you said, an employment letter, something showing that you're still employed there, because the T4 is from the last day of the previous year, that kind of thing. But for self-employed, obviously, you, as a self-employed individual, like a sole proprietor, you can't provide a T4, you can't provide a pay stub. So what banks will ask for is they'll want to see 2 years of your accountant prepared income tax returns, your full income tax return, which includes your statement of business activities, breaks down your write-offs and all that kind of stuff. And they're going to want to see 2 years of that, and they're going to take an average of the 2 years. Hmm. And so that can be an issue sometimes, like say your income the previous year was much lower, or the income, which is in the worst case scenario, is your income in the most recent year of the 2 years was lower, because they might decide, oh, we don't want to take the average. We want to take the most recent year was lower. So we want to take the lower of the two, right?
CMHC is a important part for people who don't have a 20% deposit. How does it work when you're self-employed?
So CMHC, any mortgage with less than 20% down payment, so that has a loan to value of higher than 80%, has to be insured with protected with mortgage default insurance. And CMHC is one of the two or three companies that provide mortgage default insurance, but it's the most well-known one. And CMHC will accept self-employed borrowers. However, their requirements are going to be very much what the A lenders, what the banks and credit unions are looking for. Now, CMHC does have they do acknowledge that they have a self-employed program, which means that they will add back some of the deductions that you've deducted from your gross income as a self-employed person. So they will allow a 15% gross up of business income, which kind of adds back and can increase the income a little bit. But they do also have, they do want to see that you have that you've been self-employed for at least 2 years. They will make exceptions. It's not, they might make exceptions based on if you've bought an existing business, if you have lots of cash in the bank, if you have very predictable earnings as a self-employed person, let's say you have a contract with the federal government or something like that, or if you have relevant training in the field from before you were self-employed. So they will look to make exceptions if you have not been self-employed for 2 years, but that is the standard requirement.
One of the other things that I've read is in an effort to try and demonstrate your income, sometimes the lender is willing to look at something like a revenue pipeline for businesses. Maybe you're a consultant and you've got some clarity on how many consulting engagements you're going to have in the year ahead. Are there other things like that might not be like box ticking, but might help you make the case that you're worthy of the bet that they're making on you?
Well, with an A lender, with a bank, they won't really look at that. What you're referring to there, a B lender might look at. So because they're going to have a little bit more flexibility. So a B lender might say, okay, you can't provide us, or your income according to your returns is too low, but you know what, if you can provide us with the last 6 months of bank statements showing your business income coming into your bank account, or if you, like you said, if you can show us that you've got these contracts going forward, we'll use that income instead, because they don't have the same regulation. They're not regulated as strictly as the banks are by the federal government, right? So they have a bit more flexibility.
What about tax filings? So self-employed folks, whether they're a sole proprietor or maybe they run a small corporation, they deal with personal taxes. They may well have business taxes. They may well have GST. How do those connect to the application process?
Well, you first of all, and this sometimes can be an issue when you're self-employed, is you really need to make sure that your taxes are paid, right? Mm-hmm. So sometimes a lot of self-employed people will have tax in a situation where they have tax arrears because it's not deducted from their paycheck every 2 weeks, that kind of thing, right? Yeah. So that can be an issue. So you do need to make sure your taxes are fully paid. A lenders won't want to see tax arrears, and they will also might not be willing to help you refinance or pay off tax arrears. You would have to kind of pay them on your own prior to financing a mortgage. Again, policies do kind of differ from institution to institution.
I want to ask you just one final question here, and that is timing. So a mortgage is an extraordinarily important thing, both if you want to buy and if you own a home, that renewal is really critical. What sort of time horizon should someone keep in their mind in order to make sure that this is sorted. And it's they're not going to have to stress about it in the weeks to either the closure of a purchase of a house or a renewal.
So I would say, well, first of all, in terms of if you're working in a salary job 9 to 5 and you are thinking about going self-employed, I think it's very important to make sure that you're not going to have any mortgage borrowing needs for at least a couple of years. So I that's the first thing. You know, if you can't go self-employed and plan to be able to get a mortgage within 3 or 4 months after you leave your 9 to 5 job. In terms of getting a mortgage, I mean, anytime, it can the time frames can differ between if you're buying a house or if you're just refinancing a mortgage or getting a renewal. Renewals can usually be done almost instantly. It's usually just a visit to your lender, and they can do either over the phone or online or in person very quickly. In terms of getting a new mortgage, I mean, if you're going with a bank or credit union, you're probably you definitely want to. It's a week. It's going to take some weeks. You know, they can get approval maybe within a few days, but obviously the whole process is going to take longer than that. B lenders may be able to get approvals turned around more quickly than the A lenders because their requirements, documentation requirements aren't always as strict.
Really helpful stuff, Colin. I appreciate you breaking it down for us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Colin Graves is the managing editor of Retire Happy, and he was here to talk about some of the nuance and some of the things you need to think about if you are looking for a mortgage while you are self-employed. That is our show for today. A thanks to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. In order to reach us, very simple to do. We're old school. We're like 2004 here. Email is the best way to do that. No, we don't have a phone number. What are you kidding? We're not as it happens. ask@moolala.ca is our email address. You can send us comments, questions, feedback, whatever it is, that's the best way to reach us. You can also sign up for our newsletter. It is found at moolala.ca. We have a once a month newsletter, and that is all we will ever use your email address for. On social media, I'm at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook, and that is SELLERY. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great day.